On 104.5 FM, this is WRFU LP Urbana. It's 6 p.m. on Thursday, and time for A Critical Ear, presented by Andrew O'Boyle and Robert Naiman. And good afternoon and welcome to the show. Myself, Andrew O'Boyle, joined in studio, as usual, by Bob Naiman, and also this week by Jody Blumenfeld, talking with us about Georgia, which many of you will have heard quite a bit from or about in the week gone by. First of all, good afternoon and welcome, Bob.
Good afternoon, Andrew.
And good afternoon, Jody.
Good afternoon.
Okay, let's start with Georgia. This in the, as I mentioned, most listeners will have heard quite a bit about the events in Georgia in the past week when Russian military entered some of the separatist regions of Georgia and also Georgia proper, and there's been quite a bit of military action there. This, for many of us, I think, is the most we've ever heard about the country of Georgia. In my case, pretty much my entire life. For most of us, we know that there is a country of Georgia separate from the U.S. state, but that's pretty much it. Jody, if you could start off by explaining for our listeners where is Georgia, and yeah, essentially, whereabouts is it located physically on an atlas or a map?
Okay. Well, actually, when you started, I realized I probably should have, instead of saying good afternoon, I should have said Gomarjobat, which is one of the very few Georgian phrases that I know, and it's Georgian for hello.
Gomarjobat.
Gomarjobat. Rogorikart. Which is, how are you?
Okay, and now you've created that's an infinite increase in my knowledge of Georgian.
I rarely get to use it. If you'd like, I could rattle off the different foods, the names for foods that I learned.
And no, now I want you to teach us some accession. I mean, if we're going to really be well-rounded.
Yeah.
So, Gomarjobat, listeners.
Gomarjobat. Where is Georgia? You'd like to know? Georgia is kind of at the crossroads between Europe and Asia. It's bordered to the west by the Black Sea. It's bordered to the north by Russia, and bordered to the south by Turkey, Armenia, and Azerbaijan.
Okay, so this is a country somewhat to the east or southeast of what most of us think of as Europe.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Just kind of north. It's northeast of Turkey.
Mm-hmm. And of course, up until 1991, it was part of the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, but has been independent since then?
It had. There was a really brief period of independence, I think in, was it the 18th or 19th century? I don't know how brief it was, but very, very brief. The flag that they're using now, it's like a white flag with kind of a red cross on it, and then little red, I don't know what they are, but four little red things in each corner. That was the flag they used in that first brief period of independence. And then from then till just a little while ago, they had a deep maroon flag with a black and white horizontal bars in one corner. So the flag they're using now is from that brief period of independence. So yeah, they had a little brief period in the 18th or 19th century.
And when you say, so between their brief independence and now, obviously part of the USSR for a long period, was it always domination by Russia, or was it other parties like Turkey and so on who've been...
I think it was dominated by Russia. I mean, Georgia's been sacked, you know, a good 30 times. I think Tbilisi, the capital, has been taken over a good 30 times in its history. But yeah, for the most part, by Russia.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And now you visited there, was it 2003?
I was there in 2002 and 2003. So okay. From July and August in 2002 for 6 weeks, and in the summer of 2003 for about 8 weeks.
Okay, and you're a biological anthropologist.
Yes.
You were there doing archaeological work.
Yeah, I was there. I went to participate in the excavations of it's a site called Dimonisi.
Okay.
It's a Paleolithic site, very, very old site. They've found, it's the earliest human fossils outside of Africa.
Okay.
Have been found there. So it's a site, I don't really know, it's south of Tbilisi. I don't really know the distances because the roads were really bad. And so you could drive for a couple hours and not get very far. These windy roads and really kind of bumpy and... But yeah, south of south of Tbilisi, close to the border of Armenia. That's where the site was, up in the mountains.
Okay. It's always, when you say there about, you know, distances and time, it reminds me, when I was younger, I always had the feeling that there should be maps that measured things in time rather than just in physical distance.
I agree.
Because it's just... It's perhaps as useful or more useful to know it's this chunk of time to get from here to there.
Well, it makes more sense to me when someone says it takes 2 to 3 hours to drive to Chicago than when they tell me how many miles.
Partly because the miles are incredibly misleading.
True, and I grew up with, like you, with kilometers and can't always do the conversion in my
Indeed.
Head. So hours are universal. I understand an hour. Canadian Collective hour Russia. And the American hour are the exact same.
The Canadians haven't yet taken on the metric hour or something.
Yes. One Canadian minute is equal to... 1 point. Anyways.
So you were at the site in Dimonisi.
Yes.
When you talk about, you're saying the oldest human fossils outside of Africa. Just how old are these?
The human fossils coming out of Dimonisi have been dated to 1.8 million years old.
Okay.
Which is pretty old.
When we're talking time earlier, yeah, 1.8
even
million.
Older than Bob.
Hey,
I'm teasing.
I resemble that remark.
Yeah. So you visited there.
Mm-hmm.
You spent essentially 2 summers in rural Georgia, a different area from the disputed areas that are in the news in the last while.
The area that's where the attention's been focused lately is a area called. South Ossetia or Ossetia, I'm not really sure exactly how it's pronounced, which is at the very north of the country, kind of like in the middle of the northern border, right on the border with Russia. It's kind of northwest of Tbilisi. We were maybe south, are we? I think we were southeast of Tbilisi, so we were kind of on the opposite end of the country, yeah.
Safely far away
yes.
from current bombing sites,
yes,
perhaps.
And so that's why I'm kind of hoping that the town or the little village that we were staying in, that it's okay, far away from any sort of conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I was working in Ireland in telecoms, some of the people who worked in my company also visited Georgia, and they were there as part of... essentially EU development work on the telecoms infrastructure there, and the impression I got from them was that in terms of technological development, in terms of the kind of the infrastructure, the telecoms infrastructure, telephone and so on, it was very much underdeveloped from European standards.
Oh yeah.
And also in economic terms, rather similar to what we think of coming out of Russia at the moment, in terms of kind of a crony capitalism, that you know, you'd brothers and so on, of different political leaders controlling a lot of the thing, but not a lot of economic development in terms of the infrastructure, kind of, and in rural Georgia, did you have much idea of kind of telephone access and so? And you?
No, there's 3 different Dimonisis. There's the site Dimonisi. There's the what they called Didi Dimonisi or Big Dimonisi was kind of a, I guess by American standards, like a small town the size of a small town. It was more developed than the Dominici that we were staying in, which was Patera Dominici, which is Little Dominici. Our village was very, very small. I think it had a population of 70, and all 70 people were related to each other in some form.
Well, when you've a population of 70,
yeah,
you would, yeah,
yeah. Were there phones? We had cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
People working at the site and staying in the field house, we had cell phones. The village homes that I saw, no phones. I don't think. Maybe there was one shop, kind of in the center of town, a square room where we could buy beer and some pop and candy and detergent, like laundry detergent. Mm-hmm. You know, none of it was like it was all warm. there was no refrigeration.
Okay.
You know, if you wanted something cold, you had to go put it in the river for a few hours. But she may have had a phone in that little shop. But I don't think so. Everyone was really dependent on cell phones.
Okay.
And I think that's because the telephone system was really unreliable. They didn't really have power. And even in Tbilisi, a lot of my friends would talk about how in the winter the power would go out and the heat would go and they'd kind of have to huddle around candles to stay warm. In our little mountain village, yeah, there is their infrastructure now.
Mm-hmm. And what you say there about cell phones, this of course is a developing theme worldwide, that for many people now, the first, you know, that you, up until maybe a dozen years ago, maybe mm-hmm. a billion people in the world had ever used a telephone. Now that number, I think, is something like 3 or 4 billion. But mm-hmm. for most of those, the only telephone they've ever used is a cell phone. Mm-hmm. Because, as you say, when you're in a remote location, access, you know, installing a cell phone infrastructure mm-hmm. is at this stage much easier to roll out to rural areas, to smaller populations or more dispersed populations than it is to roll out landlines house to house to house.
Yeah.
Now you mentioned there, you said even Tbilisi. Tbilisi, mm-hmm. I take it, is on the one end, you can, economically the most developed,
mm-hmm.
Is mm-hmm. the most perhaps Western in terms of.
Yeah, Tbilisi is the capital. It's quite large, actually. It's the biggest city in the country. It's, I think, the population's about 1.5 to 2 million.
Okay.
Out of a country of five to six million people.
So that's kind of the same idea, coming from Ireland, mm-hmm. Dublin dominating the country, population of 1 to 2 million out of a population of 4 or 6 on the island.
But in Ireland, you've also got Galway and Cork, which are sizable cities.
Okay.
In Georgia, outside of Tbilisi, Batumi on the Black Sea coast is big compared to, you know, Georgian standards, but still not very large. Gori, which is a town in Georgia that has also been in the news a lot. It was,
mm-hmm.
it's not far from South Ossetia, and I think the problem is that Russian troops are kind of stepping outside the boundary of this breakaway region. They've taken over Gori. I guess there was reports of gunfire and things blowing up in Gori and people having to flee mm-hmm. that town. Gori, when we drove through it, was it seemed pretty big to me. It's the birthplace of Stalin, if anyone didn't know. Stalin was actually Georgian. But after our little coming out of Dominici and spending some time in the Black Sea, Gori was a pretty sizable town. You know, buildings that were maybe 2-3 stories high, which we didn't have in.
Mm-hmm.
In
so you, you, but yeah, mid-sized. You visited Gori.
I drove through.
Okay.
In a little mini bus.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of saw it from a car. But yeah, Tbilisi is the largest city. It's the most developed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And culturally, in terms of, again, you're coming from, well, from living in the US at that stage, but mm-hmm. also coming as a Canadian, were there any particularly remarkable or interesting cultural differences you noted between, you know, Georgia? Obviously, you've got language barriers and language changes, but kind of in terms of the culture of the area, anything that was particularly interesting noteworthy?
Yeah, I mean, so much. It's just such a, it's a gorgeous country. The people there are, I haven't met such warm, wonderful, kind people. Very, very friendly, hospitable, a lot of fun. Culturally, I mean, yeah, it was a little different. The way that, you know, relationships between men and women, a little different. I guess a little bit more traditional. I guess women's roles are a bit more traditional there than here. It's changing with the younger generations. But yeah, there's language barriers. A lot of Georgians, especially the younger ones, speak English.
Okay.
The older ones will speak Georgian and Russian and either German or French. So for me, if I came into contact with the one, you know, someone who spoke French, it was okay. I had to learn French in school, and so I could get by. One of he's not American, Swiss Canadian student who was with us, is fluent in German. So, you know, with the two of us, we were it was pretty easy to communicate. The younger Georgians speak English. When I was there, they still weren't really used to tourists.
Okay.
So we got a lot of attention. It was hard to walk down the street without people knowing that we weren't from there. Even if we tried to, you know, dress kind of Georgian-like, there's a particular look. I mean, Georgians, they tend not to marry outside their culture.
Okay.
So it was very clear that we were not Georgian.
And particularly, I'm guessing when you're in a town of 70, it's fairly easy to know are the 5 or 10 or however many.
Oh, yeah, I know. When we were in Tbilisi walking.
Okay.
Yeah, walking down the street, it was, yeah. It's also, it's not a very multicultural area. It's the Caucasus Mountains, right? It's where
this is where the term Caucasian
derives
from.
Exactly. Everybody's white.
Okay.
I think we saw one Asian person walking down the street, and as you saw her walk, you could see the heads turning and following her and watching her walk. I forget whether it was 2002 or 2003. One summer when I was there, the movie Men in Black came out, and it was premiering at the movie theater on Rustaveli Street in Tbilisi, the main avenue in the city. And so to promote the movie, they had this big black tank rolling down the main street in Tbilisi one black guy in the top of the tank in all black, just kind of standing there, and people were just gaping as the tank went by. So they don't really see a lot of people who look different from them. It's just a very not a very multicultural area.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's so much of it. You were saying this is even in Tbilisi.
This was in Tbilisi, yeah, the capital.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's switch over to Bob for a moment and start talking a little about the military aspect of this event. What we're talking about, or what we've seen happen in the past week or so, has been there's dispute over, shall we say, where exactly blame should be placed, and there's been a lot of attention said, you know, either the Russians should be accused of trying to build themselves up as a second pole, or, you know, as exerting, you know, being the dominant power in this region, or the Georgians are interfering with the self-determination of these separatist regions. Is that really, do you think, is that a useful way for analysis of this to go about, or are there other ways in which we might think about this dispute and you know, its significance?
Well, there are always other ways to think about everything, aren't there? First principle would be to ask ourselves, or ask someone else, what the implications of international law are. Under international law, Georgia is a sovereign country. It's a member of the United Nations. It has internationally recognized borders. And South Ossetia is within Georgia's internationally recognized borders. So in terms of international law, there's no question that South Ossetia is part of Georgia. So that when Russia sent in its troops, it violated international law. On the other hand, there's a big on the other hand. There's a lot of on the other hands that have to be said to this. It's also true that the first event of the crisis was not of sort of this round of the crisis. This is something that goes back many years, certainly at least to 1991. But the most recent events did not begin with the movement of Russian troops into Georgia. The most recent events began with Georgia sending troops into South Ossetia, a region that, although part of Georgia under international law, has enjoyed de facto autonomy for some time, with a lot of conflict. And it's also true that there was already a long-standing relationship between South Ossetia and Russia. It's maybe worth noting that, you know, the name South Ossetia implies that there is a North Ossetia, and there is. There is North Ossetia, and that's in Russia. So so the boundary between Russia and Georgia divides North Ossetia and South Ossetia. So it's not completely bizarre that people in Russia would take some interest in events in South Ossetia, in addition to history that, you know, before 1991, this was all part of the Soviet Union, and even before the Soviet era, this was part of Russia. Nonetheless, you know, this is Georgia under international law. It was well known that Russia had an interest in the situation. Russia had made that very clear, had Russian peacekeepers in the area who were attacked by the Georgian forces. What exactly happened there is under some dispute. The Russians claim that 2,000 people were killed in the Georgian assault. Other sources say this figure is very high, and the figure was more like hundreds. But there is no question that many people were killed in the August 7th Georgian assault, including many civilians. It's also no question that many more people have been killed since the Russian response, including many civilians. It's also true that there has been a lot of questioning in the United States and elsewhere of the U.S. role in this whole affair. To what extent did the did actions by the United States government encourage the Georgian government, which is a close U.S. ally, to take this provocative action on August 7th. In other words, even if you concede the point, as I think we all should, that Russia violated international law when it intervened militarily in response to the Georgian attack on South Ossetia, you could still ask a legitimate question. You know, what was the role of the U.S. In encouraging the Georgian government to undertake this provocative and also clearly immoral attack in South Ossetia on August 7th that precipitated the current crisis? And that's a question that many people have been asking in the U.S. and elsewhere in recent days. The present U.S. government, the Bush administration, has strongly encouraged the Georgian government, has supported Georgian membership of Georgia in NATO, which people in Russia consider to be very provocative. You may recall at the time of German reunification, there was an undertaking that the U.S. would not try to extend NATO east of the Russian border. And, of course, they've been doing the opposite of that undertaking, and indeed, Georgia's right on the Russian border.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, today, the U.S. and Poland, in the shadow of the Georgian conflict, have signed a joint defense agreement which essentially places the U.S. missiles, which are part of the you know, so-called missile defense shield, in Poland, and as part of the quid pro quo, what America are going to give to, you know, this is what America gets is missiles which they're going to be able to point at. As it happens, they're talking about Iran and similar states.
Yeah, they always talk about Iran, but it's quite interesting that the complaints about this are coming from Russia, not Iran. Mm-hmm. You almost never hear Iranian officials denouncing these things they're putting in mm-hmm. Poland. They want to put them in Czech Republic too.
Maybe because Iran doesn't have missiles that would get far enough to be shot down by counter missiles.
As I know, Iran doesn't have particularly bad relations with Poland.
but the other part of the agreement, what Poland is getting, is technology which it's planning on pointing at Russia, because as far as Poland is concerned, Russia is the aggressor.
Yeah.
But you're talking about, you're saying there are questions about whether actions
right.
in the
so
U.S.
This another example that you're given is also considered very highly provocative by the Russians. Another example of a sort of antecedent to these events is the position that the U.S. and the EU have taken on Kosovo. The Russians warned, and the South Ossetians warned, actually, also, when the U.S. and the EU moved to recognize Kosovo independence, Russia and the South Ossetians said, well, okay, if you're going to do that, that's a precedent for South Ossetia to declare independence from Georgia. In fact, they already had a referendum in South Ossetia, which was not, you know, internationally recognized. But nonetheless, the indications are that the majority of people in South Ossetia do not want to be part of Georgia. That's not an absolute, you know, there are other questions that you could ask. There's a contradiction there mm-hmm. in the international system between the principle of self-determination and the principle of respect for existing international borders. But one of the reasons that in situations like in the former Yugoslavia, many people have said, you know, we should tread carefully about recognizing independence for these separatist movements is, you know, well, what precedent is it going to set for the future? And this is a concern that the U.S. and the EU decided to ignore in the case of Kosovo. And so now the issue's on the other foot. Now the U.S. and some European countries are pounding the table about the U.S., about Russia's violation of Georgian sovereignty, and Russia and the South Ossetians are saying what's good for Kosovo is good for South Ossetia.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, looking at this, and as I say, some of the commentary I was seeing, you know, where people were, there seemed to be a kind of a reflex of on occasion of if the U.S. Dislikes it, then it must be the other, you know, to say that Russia must be in the right, if, you know, somebody's looking for the good guy to oppose this side or that side. It seems to me that it depends very much on the level at which you look at this. It's almost like a fractal that, you know, if you look at it at a larger level, Russia can be seen as interfering with Georgia
is
a nation.
The simple answer is that there are no good guys in the situation. The U.S., Russia, Georgia, and the South Ossetian leadership are all, in some sense, bad guys, in the sense that all of them, to some degree, have been pursuing a maximalist strategy. So, for example, I mean, the people in South Ossetia have been pushing independence, arguably many of them implicated in ethnic cleansing of Georgians from the territory. On the other hand, Georgian government clearly has not pursued conciliatory policy. The U.S. clearly has pursued a provocative policy. Russia, in some ways, has pursued provocative policy. Clearly, again, they violated international law, killed many civilians with their intervention. So there's no good guys here. But on the other hand, I think as we're looking at the situation in the U.S., a predominant concern ought to be to disentangle ourselves from the main line of propaganda that's taking place. And the main line of propaganda that's taking place is the thing that you just mentioned, that just that Russia are the bad guys. And, oh my God, Russian aggression, with no context for the previous events, including, you know, neither the Georgian government actions nor the U.S. government actions, nor either there or the precedents set in Yugoslavia. We have seen some very funny incidents in the last week as the, you know, the like the scene change. Now all of a sudden, all the blowhards in the U.S. are going forth about international law and national sovereignty. These are the same people that supported the illegal U.S. invasion of Iraq, the illegal U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. There was a funny, there was actually a wonderful Jon Stewart riff two nights ago on The Daily Show where he made fun of the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Zalma Khalilzad, the former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, where he said, Khalilzad said, you know, in the 21st century, countries don't invade other countries in Europe. And Stewart opined that, you know, this could be the new... this is like the Chinese fortune cookie thing where you you read the fortune you add in bet. So then he did. He went through Khalilzad's thing, and he just kept adding in Europe. It was quite hilarious and quite quite on the mark. I mean, around the, you know, maybe in the U.S. echo chamber, people can get away with this stunning display of hypocrisy where you denounce Russia for violating international law and saying that, you know, you can't go around invading other countries. Of course, what they mean is that if you haven't been blessed by the United States to do so, you can't go around invading other countries. But people in other parts of the world don't buy this at all. Obviously, people in Russia don't buy it. People in South Ossetia don't buy it.
I was actually earlier this week on one of the NPR shows. I'm not sure if it was All Things Considered or perhaps one of the PRI shows on WILL. They had, again, a U.S. representative being interviewed and say pretty much this line, you can't invade other, I think they used, you know, other democratic countries. And they go, but, you know, people accuse the U.S. of having invaded countries. What democratic countries have we ever invaded? You know, not, and they said, well, since I've served with the U.S. government, and, you know, this is somebody who's, you know, been there for 3-4 years and they can, and, you know, finessed and explained how Iraq, even though it had elections because Saddam won by over 95%, he didn't count that as a democratic election. But that, you know, which is
well,
arguable.
That's a fair point.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point.
No meaningful definition of the word democracy would apply to Iraq.
But he was also finessing it with the... Sure,
it should be pointed out that when we're speaking about international law and national boundaries and national sovereignty, democracy has nothing to do with it. There's nothing in the UN Charter that says, you know, you can't invade other countries unless they're not democratic, and then it's okay. Mm-hmm. That has absolutely zero to do it. So if you're saying, okay, you know, the principle that we're going to put forward is that you can't invade other countries if they're democracies, then regardless of what you think about that, if that's the principle you're invoking, then you're not appealing to international law or the UN Charter or national sovereignty. That has nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely zero.
Plus, if you go far enough back, you know, the U.S. has played a role in invasion of various democratic nations. But,
well, first of all, Serbia was a democracy when the United mm-hmm. States intervened. I mean, again, you
it,
say,
it,
well,
it only
you know,
bombed was, Serbia. It did not invade Serbia.
Well, you know, there are foreign troops until the independence of Kosovo is universally recognized. Kosovo mm-hmm. is part of Serbia. So if there are foreign troops in Kosovo, then there are foreign troops in Serbia.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I had 2 points. One was that issue on the thing. The other escapes me for the moment.
Sorry,
so
I derailed you.
Yeah, no problem. So we will wander onto another topic.
I just want to mention one other thing on the subject of Georgia, which I think is worth noting. There's a video circulating on the internet, which is a clip from Fox News, and I encourage people to go find this. It's an interview that Fox News did with a 12-year-old girl from San Francisco and her aunt. And they had been in South Ossetia, and I guess they're South Ossetia, you know, they're like visiting relatives. They were like had been there for a couple months on August 7th when the Georgian troops attacked. So the reason that they're on Fox News was, you know, it was like American angle. Like, oh, we have this brave little girl from San Francisco who was in South Ossetia and had to flee the fighting. So the interview from Fox News starts to, you know, ask her these, oh, brave little girl, what a terrible thing you experienced questions. A brave little girl, brave little American girl from San Francisco. And the brave little American girl from San Francisco starts to answer his questions. But then she says, but the thing I want to say, you know, before I answer your question is that it was the Georgian troops that attacked us and bombed our house and from whom we had to flee. And I want to say thank you to the Russian troops for saving us. the interviewer from Fox News was just totally discombobulated. That was not part of the script at all.
How old was she?
12 years old. And then they switch to the aunt, and the aunt says something very similar. And then so that goes on for about 10 seconds. And then the Fox guy's like, well, we have to cut to a commercial. So then they cut to a commercial, then they come back, and then they say, okay, well, we have 10 seconds, or 30 seconds, so finish making your point. And what I found was very striking about this was how ham-handed it's Fox News. But still, it was just very ham-handed the way that they dealt with the situation. Obviously, you know, they had not, that wasn't the story that they anticipated. The story was supposed to be the brave little 12-year-old girl. But once they realized that, you know, these two people, had something they wanted to say about Georgia and Russia, the smooth thing would have been just to let them say their piece, you know, and move on to the next thing. After all, they're going to have 99 other people towing the party line. But their mentality is so Stalinist, for want of a better word. Like, they can't even tolerate, even though, like, it would be in their interest, just to let it go. Let the little girl say her piece and, you know, let the aunt say her piece and move on to the next thing. They're so intolerant of any dissent that, you know, they have this reaction that actually underlines, you know, puts a big red marker underneath the fact that they don't want to tolerate any dissent on their station.
As you say, at this point, there are no good guys. What I was reminded of seeing the coverage and seeing people, you know, talk about Russia wanting to exert, you know, re-exert its influence in this region, almost like a Russian version of the Monroe Doctrine, which incidentally, people are, you know, the very people who would express incredulity if one were to challenge the Monroe Doctrine, the U.S. foreign policy concept that the U.S. should exert control and influence over events in the Western Hemisphere. It's the American exceptionalism that America should do these things, but not others.
Well, the other way of looking at it is that you have people in Washington who want to, like, they want the Monroe Doctrine to cover the whole world. And they regard Georgia as, you know, like, you guys lost, their attitude is, you guys lost the Cold War, and we won. And Georgia's in the U.S. sphere of influence now, and not in the Russian sphere of influence. So they don't have, like, it's not a moral thing. It's yeah. like, you know, it's just power politics. But they want to push back and say, mm-hmm. you know, there is no Russian sphere of influence. There is a U.S. sphere of influence. And obviously that's a highly provocative thing. I want to also say, you know, having said that there are no good guys, I would also say, I think that the South Ossetians have a claim that ought to be get a fair hearing in the United States. And I'm mm-hmm. saying, like, everybody, rah rah, South Ossetian autonomy or independence. But they have a legitimate claim, and they have a legitimate grievance against the Georgian government, and it deserves a fair hearing in the United States, not to be completely dismissed, as it was in this Fox interview. Like, when this woman said, the aunt said, you know, was saying, you know, blah, blah, blah about the Georgian president, he should resign. The Fox News interview said, yes, well, that's what the Russians are saying. So therefore, of course, the implication being, your words are illegitimate because you're just a Russian stooge. Mm-hmm. And that's morally unacceptable. You know, the people in South Ossetia, okay, they have an alliance with Russia, but they're not Russian stooges. They're human beings with their own interests and deserve a fair hearing for their claims.
Jody, if I can go back to you for a moment. You've mentioned previously, I think, the South Ossetians are culturally distinct from the rest of Georgians.
It's a different ethnic group.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of, this isn't just we've talked previously here about South American provinces where, you know, it's where there are, you know, so-called autonomy movements growing up very much as, you know, means for rich political rich groups to use political tricks in order to keep their own privilege and so on. This is something where it's got deep historical roots that mm-hmm. these people feel in some way distinct from the rest of the Russian or of the Georgian people,
yeah.
rather.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. So again, you know, what I was thinking, hearing the stories, it kept being reminded of, you know, coming from Ireland, the way in which, you know, Ireland has been dominated by the UK, but also we have Northern Ireland, which is, you know, still part of the United Kingdom, and where the majority of the population, culturally and in many cases, you know, in terms of heritage, see themselves as British. And again, one of these situations where you can end up with no good guy in terms of the level at which you look at it. Here in the US, people often look from the viewpoint of, you know, Irish independence, Ireland as a free nation. Once you get down to a closer level and look and see Northern Ireland, which is largely culturally distinct, from the rest of Ireland, from you know, about 2/3 of the population, that it becomes a much more complicated and complex question than simply saying, you know, here are the physical bounds of a nation or the geographic bounds, and that can and will settle all problems.
Yeah, there are competing claims that have some legitimate basis and have to be taken into account in any peaceful political resolution of the conflict. I think that's true in both cases. The kind of maximalist approach that says, you know, okay, these people are going to be independent and that's that, and there's no concern for anyone else. Because, again, within South Ossetia, you know, you have a majority community and a minority community. So is there going to be, like, a breakaway Georgian republic within South Ossetia? There has to be some means of, you know, including the competing claims in a settlement. That's true in Ireland, and that's true in Georgia.
And of course, you mentioned Kosovo earlier. This is one of the issues that's now happening in Kosovo.
Absolutely.
With Serbian, ethnic Serbian Kosovones.
10% of the population.
Who are now claiming that their rights of secession should be recognized.
So that's the road that you start down when you dismiss these issues and treat them as if it's simple.
Jumping a little bit around the world for a bit, South America, events in Ecuador in the past week or so.
There was a Reuters item today that I thought was worthy of note. It was a report that the Ecuadorian government had indicated its willingness to mediate between Chevron and the thousands of indigenous people that have sued Chevron in this longstanding court case over toxic dumping in the Amazon. The reason that this is significant, I think, is that as was very as was reported by Newsweek earlier this month, in a very, very inflammatory article, inflammatory in the sense of being true, the Chevron has been lobbying the U.S. government to punish Ecuador for this lawsuit that's been going on. Of course, it's not Ecuador that's bringing the lawsuit. It's these thousands of indigenous people in the Amazon that are suing Chevron for the environmental devastation that's happened in this area that some have referred to as the Amazon Chernobyl. And this was dumping that was done by Texaco, of which Chevron is the successor corporation, because it bought Texaco, so it bought Texaco's obligations to these people in Ecuador. Preliminary findings in the court indicate that the liability of Chevron could be on the order of $16 billion. So it's worth a great deal to Chevron's bottom line to try to make this go away. In line with the kind of corporation that Chevron is, rather than try to make this go away by making a deal with these thousands of peasants, Chevron is trying to make it go away by lobbying the United States government to bring pressure on Ecuador to try and make the government of Ecuador to try and make this lawsuit go away. Let me also note that the two of the plaintiffs in this lawsuit, the Ecuadorian lawyers, got the Goldman Environmental Prize for their advocacy on behalf of these indigenous peasants. So Chevron's lobbying the U.S. government, and one of the things they're doing is lobbying the Office of the United States Trade Representative to punish Ecuador by withholding trade preferences that Ecuador has under current agreements to pressure Ecuador to quash the case. So this has made people in the environmental advocacy community hopping mad. And in fact, in the last few weeks, Representative DeFazio has been circulating a letter among members of Congress calling on them to tell USTR to butt out. And previously, Senator Obama and Senator Leahy had written to USTR saying that USTR should stay out and these Ecuadorian peasants should have their day in court. So this this news, this Reuters report today that the Ecuadorian government is saying that they're ready to mediate in the dispute, while on the surface of it, it might seem like, you know, kind of innocuous or even positive thing that the Ecuadorian government would say, you know, who's against mediating a dispute? You know, that seems like a positive thing. You know, disputes should be mediated. But some people are concerned because this is happening in a context where Chevron has been trying to pressure the government of Ecuador to intervene in the case.
And so this could be the end point that Chevron, or part
well,
of
not the
end
point, but Chevron but was a sign. Towards. It could be a sign that the Ecuadorian government is worried about the pressure and is responding to it. It's been reported that you know, while there's the mobilization obviously happening on the Chevron side, and I think we talked about this before, the notorious quote from the Chevron lobbyists that, you know, we can't allow little countries like Ecuador to push big companies like Chevron around. The Ecuadorians are responding, and in fact, representatives from these communities are planning to come to Washington in September to meet with members of Congress and meet with USTR to press their case that USTR should stay out and let the legal process in Ecuador play out.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, I think, the last time we talked about this, that so far you mentioned that Obama had previously written to the trade representative.
In 2006.
And that more recently he has so far stood by.
He's affirmed his position. Mm-hmm. A spokesman affirmed this remains our position, that we support the rule of law and peasants in Ecuador should have their day in court.
Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, commendable, but again, something where, you know, for those who are interested, you know, Obama's position on so many policy issues now can be something that where Obama goes, so goes much of the Democratic Party. So it's important that be maintained.
You would hope. But, I mean, when we're dealing with something like this, it's worth keeping. I mean, Chevron is a corporation with tremendous power. And if you want to see, you know, how... I mean, people like spend a lot of time complaining about the Democrats, and you know, that's a worthy activity. But it's also worth noting, that you know, the power situation that we face in the United States. I mean, look at the issue of offshore drilling, where you have this ban that's been in place for 26 years that was put in place for a reason, didn't drop down from the sky. It was a result of environmental disasters. Due to the irresponsibility of the oil industry. And so this is a longstanding U.S. policy that had widespread support, strongly supported by the environmental movement. And now there's this campaign by the congressional Republicans, now Senator McCain having switched his position, and the oil industry to lift the ban, using as leverage the concern, legitimate concern, that people have about gas prices. But tricking people, with the aid of the completely defective and incompetent U.S. news media, tricking people into thinking that lifting this ban is going to do something about gas prices. In fact, a recent poll indicated that more than half of Americans think that if the ban on offshore drilling is lifted, that would cause U.S. gas prices to fall within a year. That's a completely, you know, in the reality-based world, that's a nonsensical belief. The U.S. government energy agency said it wouldn't be many years before there's any new oil, and even then it was too small to have an effect. Most people don't know this. So the context that we're facing is one in which the Democratic leadership in the House and the Senate knows perfectly well everything that I just said and has been saying the same thing. And you have people like Paul Krugman in the New York Times, Bob Herbert in the New York Times, saying the same thing. This is a fraud. This is a hoax. This isn't going to do anything about gas prices. But so far, truth is losing this debate in the United States. So it's a positive thing that Senator Obama sent this letter to USTR, but we should take no comfort. Because, you know, compared to Chevron, Senator Obama is just one guy. You know, compared to the U.S. oil companies, Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama and the New York Times, against the oil companies and the U.S. corporate news media, like that, those are bad odds. So there's no reason for people to be complacent just because Senator Obama sent a nice letter.
Mm-hmm. Over to Bolivia, events in Bolivia.
There was a referendum on Sunday a recall referendum for the president of Bolivia, the vice president, and most of the governors in Bolivia. This was something
that the president had...
It was actually initiated by mm-hmm. the opposition and Congress. But the president went along with it because he was confident that he would win and renew his mandate. Mm-hmm. There's a huge, bitter struggle going on in Bolivia. The president, President Morales, was elected on a platform of reforming the constitution, reforming the national policy so that the majority would benefit from the country's energy resources, not just the narrow elite, just as in Ecuador and Venezuela. We have governments that were elected on a similar platform, trying to carry out similar policies. There's a very bitter opposition in Bolivia, even more bitter than in Venezuela and Ecuador. You mentioned the autonomy movements. That's primarily motivated by, I would say, by this contest over resources, opposition to the government's land reform, opposition to the government's effort to redistribute the resources of the country more equitably. So now we've had this referendum on Sunday. President Morales was reconfirmed. He won like 67% of the vote. Four of the opposition governors were reconfirmed. Two of the opposition governors lost and just announced today that they would accept the, or in the last day that they would accept the results and resign from office. So I think this is worth note in the United States. This is something that's not really getting a lot of press. There was some press on Monday right after the referendum. But some of the press was misleading. The Washington Post had an article saying, oh, divisions remain. This hasn't resolved anything. In fact, today, President Morales and the four opposition governors agreed to meet and try to work out a peaceful, negotiated resolution of their conflicts.
Mm-hmm. And very briefly, quite a bit of coverage in the past week, the death of the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish.
Yeah, I think you mean quite a bit of coverage in the alternative press.
Well, my apologies. My news diet is rather skewed.
No, it's a very nutritious news diet, but we just sort of keep in mind what's going on generally. Yeah, Mahmoud Darwish, often referred to as Palestinian national poet, died after heart surgery in Houston, was buried in Ramallah, I think, this week. There was a big funeral procession in Ramallah. He was he wrote the poem Identity Card. Of course, he wrote it in Arabic. That's the English name of the poem. Hawiye is the Arabic. And this is a very famous poem that expresses the struggle of Palestinians under Israeli occupation. How much time do we have? I can give you the first stanza.
Go with it and we'll edit.
So the first stanza in Arabic is Sajil an Arabi wa raqam bataqati khamsun alif wa atfali thamani وتسهم ساعتي بعد السيف فهل تغدي. And the translation in English is put it on record, I am an Arab. It's the context is comes clear from the poem, is a Palestinian speaking to an Israeli, like in a police station, speaking to an Israeli policeman, being asked name, rank, serial number. So he says, put it on record, write it down, I am an Arab, and the number of my identity card is 80,000. I have 8 children, and the 9th of them is coming after the summer. What is there to be angry about? And that's the structure of the poem. It just repeats this theme of, put it on record. This is who I am. This is my identity. Why do you hate me? Why do you want to kill me? So so one can imagine, with such a poem, and much of, especially his earlier poetry, was similar, expressing the Palestinian national aspirations. What a significant event this is for Palestinians, his death, and what a significant spokesman he was for the Palestinian national cause.
We are at the end of our show. Thank you very much for listening. Jody, if you would do the honors of a few more phrases in Georgian for our listeners.
Sure, I can say Didi Madloba, which is thank you very much
Didi
for
Madloba.
Having me. Didi Madloba. Chame Mishvidabisa, which is good evening or good night. What else can I say? Nakvamdis, which is goodbye. And I'll end with Mesakar Velo Mikvas, which is I love Georgia.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us this evening, Jody. Much appreciated. Thank you, of course, to Bob and to our listeners. Stay tuned to WRFU and tune in again for another edition of A Critical Ear, this time next week.